This is a Gone Fishing edition of Tell Joy Where to Go. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the hour each week when we celebrate life in Wisconsin and the Upper Midwest, and we discuss recreation and travel and culture. And today we will explore fishing history and culture in the Midwest. Have you spent any time fishing on any of the tens of thousands of lakes or in the Northwoods of Wisconsin or Minnesota, or neighboring states for that matter? What is the lure of fishing? And do you have a story to tell about the one that did or did not get away? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. By the way, we are broadcasting live from our Wisconsin Public Radio studios on the UW Green Bay campus. If you're in the neighborhood, you can stop by. You won't see much. I can wave to you through the window. Maybe I can pop out during the news breaks. But if you'd like to see a live radio show from the UW Green Bay campus, you can stop on by. I think we even have a pastry and a cup of coffee for you. We had a fabulous listener appreciation event last night at the Tidal Town Brewing Company in Green Bay. Such great listeners showed up. I think we had about 300 listeners attend the event last night. I was privileged to shake the hands of many, and thanks to all who came out. Let's welcome our guests now as we go fishing in the Midwest. Eric Dragne is with us. He is an associate professor of English and journalism at Concordia University in St. Paul. He is the author of more than a dozen books, and his latest is Let's Go Fishing, Fish Tales from the Northwoods. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great. Thanks very much for being with us. So tell us about your own history with fishing. Were you somebody who was out there as a wee lad?
Yeah, about this time of the morning, you know, you get out on the boat, and it's most of my dad hauling us out of bed at the cabin, and got to get out there in the little, with our Evinrude motor, putzing around the lake up in northern Minnesota. Yeah, those early mornings, that's when you catch all the fish.
Yeah.
So I'm not one of those fishermen who have to get out there for the opener. You know, I kind of prefer I'd wait until the middle of the summer, you know, and fish off the dock and go trolling out on the lakes.
Well, fishing is one of those activities that's not exclusive to the Midwest, yet it seems to have taken on a life of its own in this region. Why do you think the Midwest and fishing go together so well?
Just because of all of our beautiful lakes up here in the north. I mean, that's what you do. You know, especially early in the morning, you have the mist rising off the lake, the sun rising there, and, you know, you just wet a line out on the lake. It's great.
Yeah. And you are in Minnesota, where there are 10,000 lakes, and here in Wisconsin, we have like 15,000 lakes.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. You just go everywhere, and, you know, no road is straight because you always run into a lake.
Yeah. Right? Well, your book comes at fishing culture from all sorts of angles, from history to fish art to everything in between. Why did you want to tackle fishing in the Midwest as a subject?
Well, I'd lived abroad for a few years. I was born in La Crosse, and then coming back in the summer, going to camp in Icago and in Amory and going up in northern Minnesota, and then realizing that we have it's a very distinct culture here. It's different from ocean fishing or netting or any of that kind of stuff. And it's, just to celebrate that part of the culture. And not just this book is not a how to fish. I would not be the person to write that. But just these kind of odd little fishing stories that we have here. And to not forget about that, especially with kids nowadays, how they, you know, they want to be on their phones, they want to be on their little devices, to remember to get outside and to enjoy this beautiful weather.
You say that your kids do enjoy getting out on the dock, and they can leave their technology behind.
Yeah, grudgingly at first, of course. but, you know, like up at my folks have a place up north in the northern Minnesota, and they go out on the dock, and they just cast off the dock, and they catch as many sunnies as my grandparents or my parents can pull off the line. You know, they just put them in and pull them off. And it's not so much about eating the fish. You know, that's where they start to get kind of disgusted that you have to cut it open and all of that. But it's just the idea of that you caught something
You know, I also have my history with fishing. My dad was a fisherman. He loved to go fishing in his rowboat on a lake in northern Wisconsin, and he taught me how to fish. And it was not so much catching the fish that I didn't so much care about catching the fish at all. I wanted to get out in the boat with Dad, and I wanted to get some sun, and we got to talk, and yes, it was exciting to see the bobber go down every once in a while, but that wasn't all there was to that that fishing trip. How about you?
Yeah, it was more just being out there, and then you know, when the sun rises, that's when it starts to get hot and long, and then you get hungry, and you know, there's all of those stories that you tell too. But then when you do come back with a good northern or a walleye, you know, to show off, I mean, that's what makes it worthwhile then.
And I imagine many anglers view fishing as purely a recreational activity, but as you point out in the book, some view it as an almost spiritual experience. What do you think that's all about?
Well, I think it's just the idea of getting away. I mean, especially, you know, you have, I mean, we talk about the fishing widows, you know, on the fishing opener that, you know, didn't fall this year on the governor's fishing opener and all that, didn't fall on Mother's Day. But, you know, like the women are left at home until the guys get out there, and it's like they finally get their peace of mind in a way, right? Or the ice houses, you know, you get away, and you just, I mean, it's the closest thing we have to meditation. You're sitting there, and you just have time to think away from everything.
Also, a big economic driver in the Midwest. Do you have a sense on just how big it is?
Yeah, I put the figure somewhere in here, but I was surprised. I couldn't believe it's just billions of dollars that go into it. I forget how many billions here we have.
It's a huge.
2011. $2.5 billion in Minnesota alone, right?
That's amazing,
Yeah, incredible. I mean, and then we include Wisconsin, Michigan. I mean, then it just goes from there. I mean, it's just immense how much of an industry this has become.
And it's used as a tourism draw throughout the Midwest.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, people come up here. I mean, we're spoiled being up here in the North Woods. You know, we think, oh, we just go out to the lake and to the cabin. But, you know, most down south, a lot of, you know, actually right after the Civil War, a lot of the Southerners would come up here, especially to escape that summer heat down there, and to come up to the lakes. I mean, we think how warm it is here, but imagine down there. So, I mean, it's, you know, we're spoiled with these beautiful lakes up here. We got something special.
Yeah, and we certainly will have lots of warm summer months ahead to go fishing, but because we're so resourceful here in the Midwest, we have found a way to fish year-round, and we can do it quite comfortably in the winter, too. Can you talk a little bit about our love of ice fishing?
Yeah, you know, you know, you think of ice fishing, you put a little shack out on the lake, and actually I lived in Italy for a few years, and when I was there, I would explain to the Italians, well, you know, the lakes freeze over, and so we walk out on the lakes, and they don't believe you. And so I say, well, then we cut a hole in the lake, and we put a line down in there to catch fish. Don't believe you. Sometimes we put a little house out there, and then we actually put a heater inside. No way. And then we drive our car out there to get to the ice house. No, I mean, like, fantastic stories, but no one can believe that. And then nowadays, there's this place that makes these kind of ice castles, they call them, that are essentially like these RVs that you bring out onto the lake. And some of them even have air conditioning, because in the summer, then they double as an RV. And so I called up the company that makes these. I said, well, you know, these things must weigh a ton, or several tons. And don't they fall through the ice? And he said, oh.
They do, don't they?
Yeah, just look at the Facebook page, and, you know, some of them, if they leave them too long in the spring, yep, they have a bunch of pictures of them falling into the ice. And, I mean, it's terrible. It's one thing to have a little shack out there, and it's another thing to have an expensive motorhome. But they have, you know, televisions, they have full kitchens, they have, some of them have showers inside of them, and just, it's kind of wild.
Yeah.
Too luxurious, maybe.
We're gonna check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will continue talking about fishing in the Midwest. We'll talk some about the history of fishing. Why do you know why we have so many carp in our lakes in Wisconsin and Minnesota. We'll find out about that. And we will welcome any questions you have, any observations you might have about fishing culture in the Midwest. Talking with our guest, Eric Dragney, who is an associate professor of English and journalism at Concordia University in St. Paul, author of more than a dozen books. His latest is Let's Go Fishing, Fish Tales from the Northwoods. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Once about Claire, hey, thought I saw a bear, hey, I had a creep up that state fair, hey, I've been over there.
Green Bay, Beloit, La Crosse, Mountain.
I tell you why I can't find you. Every time I go out to your place, you gone fishing.
Ah, you know.
Well, there's a sign upon your door.
Uh-huh.
Gone fishing.
I'm real gone, man.
You ain't working anymore.
Could be.
This is a Gone Fishing edition of Tell Joy Where to Go. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about fishing history and culture in the Midwest, and we are wondering, what is the allure of fishing for you? Do you have a memory to share or a fish story to tell? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are talking about fishing with the author of Let's Go Fishing. Eric Dragney is our guest. He's also an associate professor of English and journalism at Concordia University in St. Paul. Well, we have a caller who has a fishing story for us. Dan in Drummond is with us. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. My fishing story is true. Back in the 70s, when I still lived in Mellon, I was taking my mom to town. Now, Bad River, which is the local river that goes through Mellon and that, came closest to the road where we were. We had a dog, a mixed dog, that loved to go down by the river when we were there and bite at little minnows that were around. Well, this one day when Ma and I were going to town, he comes up on the side of the road with at least a 14-inch rainbow trout in his mouth, which he took home and ate.
He caught his own dinner, huh?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my goodness. That's pretty funny. Well, do you believe that's a true story, Eric?
Well, stranger things have happened. You know, and you know, some of the different ways that people would catch fish, you know, they talk about wiring trout and wiring pike, that they would put down this little wire that's a sort of a noose at the end and kind of lure the trout in and then whip it up real quickly, which it seems almost impossible because, you know, if you ever put your hand down and try to catch a minnow in the water, you never do it. You never catch them.
I thought that Dan was going to say that a fish caught the dog's nose or something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm like glad that was not the case.
Like all the sunfish that are always nibbling at you and such. You know, people worry about the muskies or things like that, but it's usually the sunfish that nibble at you, right?
Yeah, yeah. Talk a little bit about the fish story. It's always the one that got away, or it was this big, but it really wasn't.
Yeah, well, and it's always fun, like, trying to find the biggest fish. And, of course, the largest fish we have around here are the sturgeon. And early on, the sturgeon, people just thought were sort of this garbage fish, you know, these rough fish, these terrible fish. And so out on Lake Michigan, they would catch so many of these sturgeon, and, you know, when they would be netting for other fish, that they would dry them and use them as firewood. In there, the boilers, the steamer. Yeah, just because they thought they were these terrible fish, or, you know, they didn't, you know, they have to get rid of them. And you mentioned earlier about carp, right?
Mm-hmm.
So carp now in our lakes make up more, in most lakes make up more than half of the biomass. So of all the, if you took all the fish out, the weight of the carp would be more than half of them. Mm-hmm. And they're not a native fish. So how these fish came came to be here was that a lot of the German and some of the Scandinavian immigrants who came to the Midwest wrote to the Congress and said, you know, we need to bring in carp. And
why did they think they were so desirable?
Well, because back in Germany, they are. They're like the great fish. And I have a friend from the old East Germany, who said that every winter her family would get a big carp and they would keep it in their bathtub until it was Christmas Eve, and that then they would cook it up. So actually, they couldn't take a shower or anything leading up to Christmas, which had some other effects, right? The Germans, especially when they came here, they wanted all of these beautiful lakes to be stocked with carp. And so finally, the Congress said, okay, they got some carp. They shipped them over from Europe, and some of them they actually kept in the reflecting pool at the Washington Monument because they're considered such a valuable fish there. And then they brought them across to the Midwest in these boxcars, you know, filled with water, obviously, for the fish. And when they were arrived in the stations here, they actually had to have armed guards because people were so eager to get these fish. And so they didn't think that they would make them all the way out to Wisconsin and Minnesota, because along the way, you know, in Michigan, Ohio, they would take a lot of these fish to stock their lakes. So all of the carp that we have in the lakes have been stocked, and of course it just went crazy and took over. And because they're a bottom feeder and they muck around, they get the flavor of that water. So if the carp grow up in a pristine lake with no muck or anything, they probably taste really good. But as it is, they are, in our lakes, you know, we have sort of the soil and all of that in there that gives them this terrible flavor. So, you know, if we could only bring our lakes back to how they originally were, but see, you know, at this point where we stock, you know, for muskie and all these other fish, that we sort of expect them to be a certain way.
I mean, we want to. There have been other efforts to stock various bodies of water with different kinds of fish. Have any of these efforts really worked?
Well, in the Great Lakes, you know, we've tried to stock. I mean, we've done, you know, now we stock with muskie and lots of these other ones. And they, you know, it works, yeah. I mean, it never works that well, because then we have to keep stocking them often. So in the Great Lakes, we wanted to bring in salmon because, you know, what's better than a nice salmon steak? And so they tried to bring in salmon, and, you know, with very mixed success. But they also brought in the smelt to help feed the salmon, and the smelt went crazy, and the salmon didn't do so well. And so there were so many smelt in the Great Lakes in certain years, you know, the smelt runs that everyone would go out there with their buckets and their waders and gather all these fish and have smelt fries. And then over in your neck of the woods there, they would, two rivers in that area, they would get all of the smelt. There were so many smelt on the beaches that washed up on the Lake Michigan sometimes that they had to get bulldozers out to remove them. And then one year, right before the war, they had a smelt festival there. And that's when they filled up a wrestling ring and had smelt wrestling there.
Gosh, so, what, how would they wrestle the smelt?
No, they would wrestle each other in smelt, like rather than in Jell-O or anything like that. So that's just what you do, I guess. Get so many smelt, what do? You wrestle in it.
Yeah, the fish festivals have come a long way since smelt wrestling, but there are still plenty of interesting celebrations. What are some of the other unique ones that you've come across?
Well, one of my favorites, you know, talking about the carp and then the bullheads, of course. There's in Fulda, Minnesota, they have so many of these rough fish in their lake that rather than, you know, just netting them all and getting rid of them, they catch all of the carp and they feed them to the town, the big town feed. And then in Waterville, Minnesota, they have bullhead days. So there they get all the bullheads. And, you know, if you've ever caught a bullhead, you have to be very careful because they can kind of sting you. So you have to wear thick gloves. And so they, you know, pull off the skin with a pliers, and they deep fry them, and, you know, anything is good deep fried, right? So, I mean, this idea that, well, we have all these fish, you know, certain, of course, everyone wants walleye, that's the most prized fish, but what about all these other good fish? So just go down to that pond that has too many carp, net them all, and then serve them to everybody in town. Why not?
We're talking about fishing and fishing culture in the Midwest with our guest, Eric Dragney, who is the author of Let's Go Fishing, Fish Tales from the Northwoods. And we're wondering if you have a fish tale to tell or a question for our guest, maybe a favorite fish festival or anything fish-related. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's talk a little bit about how cities and towns in the Midwest take pride in calling themselves things like the walleye capital of the world or the muskie capital of the world. You point out in the book that competition for these titles is pretty serious.
Yeah, you know, because, I mean, this book involved, you know, hundreds of hours of traveling all around to all the little towns that have a claim to the fishing capital or, you know, some other story there. And, you know, you get the giant statues everywhere. Of course, the biggest over in Hayward. But so many of them declare themselves, you know, the walleye capital or the walleye capital of the world or, you know, the muskie capital or the muskie capital of Wisconsin or international or, you know, so, and there's no official board, of course, that oversees, like, well, can you actually say that or not? Or it's sort of like, you know, with the world's largest statue of whatever, you know, no one is there usually measuring these things. And then with that walleye, this little town up in northern Minnesota, right near Lake of the Woods, called Baudette, they'd always declared themselves the walleye capital of the world. You know, but many other towns do as well. And so they took it a step further. And so what they wanted to do is they gathered all of their documentation to make it show that they were actually the walleye capital. I don't know quite how you do that, but they registered themselves with the U.S. government, with a trademark office. And amazingly, they granted it, which you think, okay, how do you decide? You know, and then like when I talked to the tourist board up there, I'm like, well, what do you do with that now? Like, if now that you are officially the walleye capital, and you know, are you going to sue others? They're like, you know, well, we could, but you know, obviously, you know, that would be a pretty interesting case to bring into court. Like, you know, are you actually going to bring someone down because of this? So, I mean, even if they have registered it, you know, other people still declare themselves the capital of this and that.
Do other cities besides Hayward have giant fiberglass fish?
Oh yeah, there's so many. I mean, that, you know, the walk-through muskie there is,
yep.
I mean, that's the king of them. But what, 145 feet long, and they're made down in Sparta, Wisconsin. And they shipped it up there, and of course it blocked traffic for days, you know, trying to get into town with this giant fish. But yeah, there are many, many statues around. Yeah, I don't even know where to begin. One of my favorites in northern Minnesota, this little teeny little town called Bena, they wanted a fish statue, and they also wanted, this is back when drive-through restaurants were all the craze in the 60s, they wanted a McDonald's or a Burger King or one of those chains to come in, but they decided, you know, they were, it was too small, too out of the way. So they made their own giant fish drive-through. So it's this big fish. They essentially took 2x2s and they steamed them to kind of bend over to make the ribs, tacked on a bunch of tar paper, and painted this big fish. It's a really big fish that you go inside. They had a kitchen inside, a little drive-through window alongside of it, so people could drive up right next to it and order their fish burgers or whatever. And it's still standing incredibly, and it's been in movies like National Lampoon and some others because it's one of the more famous ones because it's really a handmade giant fish that's there.
We're talking about fishing in the Midwest. We are celebrating fishing, the culture of fishing in our neck of the woods. And we're welcoming your questions for our guest or stories about what fishing means to you. Do you have memories about fishing on a lake in the Northwoods? Do you still go fishing? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm surprised we don't have any callers who want to brag about that one that got away or the record breaker that they got. I don't know if I really have a fish story to share, but I'll I do remember once pulling in what I thought was the biggest lunker in the world, and I was really excited. I was just an adolescent, I don't know, 10 years old maybe. And it turned out it was a giant snapping turtle, Eric. So.
Oh, wow.
And that thing got let go right away. What about you? Do you have a fishing story to share?
Well, the famous fishing story in my house was always, you know, my folks went out and they caught, there was this giant northern, you know, of course, and it gets longer each year, you know, first it was a foot long, now 2 feet, then 3 feet long, and they brought it up to the boat, and they didn't have a net, right, and so they couldn't get it, and, you know, so they, like, tried to use a raincoat to pull it in. Of course, that didn't work, and the fish broke the line and got away, and forever after, that was the one fish that got away, of course.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
right.
And everyone, I mean, there's always a similar story to that. You know, there's the one that got away. Right? One of the great stories, though, up in Rhinelander, this fellow, Eugene Shepherd, who sort of invented the whole hodag myth up there, but he's a prankster, and so he had a resort out there and wanted to bring more people to his lake, to his resort. And so when people would come and visit, he hooked up out in the lake these mechanical muskies. So it was out, you know, these fish that he would, you know, these mechanical fish that he would have jumping out of the water, but just far enough away that you couldn't really tell what it was, right? So you could see, there's a fish, you know, and someone would catch a glimpse of it. And so, you know, then all these tourists say, oh, yeah, that is a really big fish. And then they would go out there, and they wouldn't catch anything. But they knew that the fish were there because they saw these mechanical muskies that were just a big old hoax out there.
Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, it really. Tell us the story about the all the old photographs we see of, you know, everybody's got to pose with their big fish. And then there's even some where the fish are just ridiculously big as a human even.
Yeah. I mean, so some of the early historical pictures you see of people catching all of these fish, and a lot of times it was a day's fishing, and they would catch, you know, 100 fish. And they talked about the early days, too. You know, they would say certain times there were so many fish you could actually walk across the water, of course, you know, all the exaggerations that go along with it. So you have those early photos that are actually a documentation of how many fish they did indeed catch, and you wonder if they could actually eat all those fish. And then once the trick photography came along, and they would kind of cut and paste, and, you know, you've probably seen those old postcards of someone hauling in this fish on a train car or something, but they're so big, and people at the time didn't realize that you could do that with trick photography, so a lot of times people believe these photographs, actually.
And we have some,
go ahead.
I was going to say, we do have some callers who will have fish stories to share now, and we have a newscast coming up, so let me go to Ken in Eau Claire. Hi, Ken.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. What? Did one get away from you?
No, it didn't get away. I'm bragging. I caught a sawguy, which is a cross between a walleye and a sauger. And it would be the state record if the DNR recognized it. They don't recognize it because it's a subspecies.
Oh, no.
No fair.
You could be a record holder, but, yeah, no one will admit it.
How big was it, Ken?
It was about 28 3/4 inches long, and it weighed over 10 pounds.
Wow. I've never heard of that subspecies. Eric, have you? Eric, have you heard of that subspecies? Maybe we lost our guest. So you know what? I think we're going to have to try to reestablish contact. And in the meantime, I will remind you that this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about fishing or fishing culture in the Midwest, 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
I went down by the fishing hole, and I sat down with my fishing pole. Some grabbed my hook, and they got my bait, and they jerked me out in the middle of the lake.
Fishing culture in the Midwest is unlike anything else. We celebrate our love of fishing with everything from giant fiberglass fish to elaborately designed ice shanties. And who can forget about fish fries? We are digging into the uniqueness of fishing in the Midwest. We invite you to share your fish stories as well at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the hour each week when we celebrate life in Wisconsin and the Upper Midwest, and we talk about the many things that make this region special. One of them, of course, is fishing culture. And we are talking about fishing with the author of Let's Go Fishing, Fish Tales from the Northwoods. Eric Dragney is an associate professor of English and journalism at Concordia University in St. Paul. And one thing we haven't talked about yet, Eric, is eating fish. That's a huge part of Midwestern culture. We're all familiar with fish fries, and we love our fish fries. Maybe to a lesser extent, fish boils. I always love a good fish boil up in Door County. Let's talk a little bit about those. What's the story behind fish boils?
Yeah, with fish boils, it's mostly on the Lake Michigan coast there, and Lake Superior as well. It's an Icelandic tradition of, you know, you get all the nice fish together. And I lived over in Norway for a year, and they talked about how they would usually boil their fish. And we think, why would you want to boil fish? Don't you lose all its flavor? And for them, a fish boil is how you preserve the fish's flavor. Because once you deep fry it or you put all these other spices and things on it, you lose the flavor of it. So if you do it really hot, nice salty water, actually you just taste the fish. I mean, if you like the taste of fish, I mean, I love the taste of fish. So the fish boils, yeah, that's kind of a big tradition there. And you get a nice cauldron of water boiling, and then when it's ready to go, you put in the fish for, you know, 5-10 minutes, and then you put a little kerosene on the fire, which causes this huge fireball, causes the water to overflow and douse flames. And it's the you have there. But what was interesting in researching this book is all the different ways that people actually eat fish. So we think fish fries on Fridays and all that, or smoking fish. But then the Scandinavians oftentimes would, they have something called gravlax, which is like grave salmon, or like, you know, they would put it underground for a little bit, for preserve it for like 3 days, 3-4 days. And so it's especially we have around Christmas time, and it's uncooked fish. It's essentially cured salmon, and so it's a little Norwegian sushi. And then the other one that they have, which is pretty crazy, called rockfisk, that's the one that they bury underground for 3 to 4 months.
That's the grossest mentioned one.
Yeah. So I was able to have that when I was over in Norway, and it's a pretty powerful fish.
I didn't hear the pronunciation of that. Is that the lutefisk?
Lutefisk, yeah. So, and then with lutefisk, so there's rockfisk, which is the buried fish, and then lutefisk. I really researched how lutefisk came into being. Was in the earliest written reference to it is in 1555, and they figured that the Vikings or the early Norsemen were out fishing. They caught a bunch of great cod, and then they cleaned them, and they had to leave their site in a hurry, so they left some of the fish fillets there. So they were had cooked some of the fish over birch wood fires, and so there's birch ash left, and so then the fish were in these puddles, so they left the fish there in the puddles with this birch ash, and birch ash makes lye, which is what the lute is in lutefisk. And so these fish sat there soaking in this lye, and then when the explorers came back a month or two later, they found this old fish sitting there preserved in this lye, this watery lye
substance here. They washed it all off, and they thought they were starving, so they ate it. And they said, hey, this actually works pretty well to preserve our fish. So thus, lutefisk was born.
Can you briefly tell us the story behind the lawyers? What are they, and how did they get their name?
Okay, so this is the difference between Minnesota and Wisconsin. Because in Minnesota, we call these fish eel pout. And they're up in Walker, Minnesota, they have the big eel pout festival in the winter, and they have this big ice fishing festival, and they elect a mayor out on the lake and everything. So when I came over to Wisconsin, I went up to Door County, took the boat across to Washington Island there, and there's, you know, there used to be lots of commercial fishermen on Lake Superior, and there really aren't so many anymore. There's a little restaurant there, and they had a sign on the window saying fresh lawyers. I said, what on earth is this? You know, only in Wisconsin. So I asked the owner there, who was a fisherman, and he said, oh, lawyers, yes. And I kind of figured out that these were eel pout or burbot, they're sometimes called. And he said, we call them lawyers here because they're an ugly bottom-feeding fish. And so that's how they got their name, apparently.
All right. To the lawyers listening, that was not our name for the fish. Let me take a caller. We have Brooke in Minneapolis who has a fish story for us. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, how are you? No, I'm a lawyer, so I'm deeply insulted.
I'm sorry.
Well, my fish story is about a stocked lake in the Catskills of New York at Lake Mohonk, and it was very exciting when my daughter caught her first fish. I have to say, to watch your child catch their first fish is truly one of the great moments of your life. And I'm not very good at fishing, but we were there, and there was another minister who was a guest there, and he helped say, you know what, you put your line really deep in a lake if you want to catch a deep lake trout. So she did, and he's a really remarkable guy because he is a Lutheran minister, and he catches fish from that lake and brings it back for a fish fry in Brooklyn. His congregation really appreciates that in a kind of impoverished area, so bringing back fish is a pretty big deal. So that's my fish story.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That's wonderful. You know, we only have about a minute or so to go, Eric, so I'm just wondering if you have some final thoughts on in this age of distraction. Do you think fishing is actually getting more popular than ever?
I mean, that's what the statistics show. But I wonder if that how true that is. Because we have, I mean, the statistics in terms of how much is spent on them. And, I mean, like the caller from Minneapolis, that I think that we have this idea that to go fishing now, you have to buy all of this fancy equipment and all of these fish finders, these mechanical things that look down in the water and tell you exactly the depth and where the fish are and all of that. And it's just not that way. I mean, people have fished before, you know, as long as they've hunted, right? So, you know, we found some of these early hooks going back thousands and thousands of years that it is not that complicated. You know, you go and you dig up some worms, and we talk about worm charming, which is a whole other thing, but you get some worms, you put them on a hook, and you drop them in the lake. And, I mean, that's the simplest way to do it, that we can just go out there. You don't need to be, you know, these professional fishermen and go out and catch 100 of fish. You know, a lot of times it's just the best fish, I think, are sunfish. You know, they're the tastiest to eat. Everyone wants walleye, but, you know, there are many other fish in the sea, as they say.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We were talking with Eric Dragne, who is the author of Let's Go Fishin'. Fish Tales from the Northwoods. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. For many Wisconsinites, fishing is more than just a pastime. One Shawano angler is making waves in a male-dominated sport.
I've never had that go out, throw the bobber out, drink a beer, and oh, this is, you know, fun and relaxing. If it rains, we're going to go in. I never had that. I've always had the drive. There are those of us that cannot turn this off. My name is Marianne Husky, and I am a professional walleye angler. Well, we're starting up the four-stroke Strike Master auger. Real easy to use. I grew up in Charlevoix, Michigan. I guess you could say from a child I was always outside. My father didn't have any sons, so I was the one that was helping him in the garage, using a chainsaw to help cut up wood. And then my grandfather and grandmother retired on Lake Michigan. He would take me out on the Great Lakes for salmon. So that's where the fishing obsession began. This is a Plano box full of Berkeley Flicker Shad, number 7. So I probably have about 20 different crankbait boxes, just with the Berkeley Flicker Shads, then the Kin Chow Minnows, then the Reef Runners, etc., etc., etc. When I caught my first walleye, which was through the ice, it absolutely was so exciting. As a matter of fact, I was so excited that I showed everyone, and then I turned around and threw it back down the hole. And then I didn't want to tell anyone that I did that. So it was one of those mistakes that we've all made.
How many lures do you think you have?
Oh, my gosh. Maybe 5,000, 6,000?
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to count them. The first professional tournament I fished was in April of 2009. At the time, my husband and I owned a construction company, and I had just shut down a clothing store that I had owned for 5 years. The week after, he fell off the porch, had a head injury, and had a heart attack previous to that. So he was on blood thinners, and his brain hemorrhaged instantly.
At that point, you know,
I was ready to quit.
Yeah.
Yes. The other professional anglers said you need to keep going. Being on the water, it helped. In 2012, I won the Angler of the Year award. It's very difficult to get. I was the first female to obtain this award. It was probably, for me, the best day ever, just because it was my grandfather's birthday that day. He had passed away the year before, and he was my inspiration, so everything clicked that day. That was by far my best day on the water.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org. Thank you very much to Bill Martins, to Nyasia Ellison, Brianne Chasso for producing this program. Thanks also to Kemper Moss, Ellen Clark, Karina Abrego, and Cheryl Gasser. This is the Ideas Network.